Good evening. Welcome to the Just Sleep podcast. I'm Tayshia, your host. Every week, I will read you an old story to help you relax, put the stressful day behind you, and drift off to sleep. Occasionally, we will run ads in order to cover the costs of the production of the podcast. Rest assured, there will be no ads during or after the story. If you prefer an ad-free and intro-free show, you can join Just Sleep Premium. Visit justsleeppodcast.com/support for more information.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thank you to the recent reviewers on Audible, Abby, Chelsea, Nicola, and Henry. I really appreciate your positive feedback. Also, a quick shout out to some new members on Just Sleep Premium: Leah, Trudy, Bonnie, Carrie Ann, and Lily. I've decided to keep the free trial of Just Sleep Premium open for a few more weeks. So if you want to check out bonus episodes and ad-free listening, head over to justsleeppodcast.com/support and sign up. Or, if you're an Apple user, just hit the try free button. Now on to tonight's story. Tonight, I continue the story Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. So lie down, close your eyes, and let me read you a story. Chapter 11. Experiments. The 1st of June. The kings are off to the seashore tomorrow, and I'm free. 3 months' vacation. How I shall enjoy it, exclaimed Meg, coming home one warm day to find Joe laid upon the sofa in an unusual state of exhaustion, while Beth took off her dusty boots and Amy made lemonade for the refreshment of the whole party. Aunt March went today. Oh, be joyful, said Jo. I was mortally afraid she'd ask me to go with her. If she had, I should have felt as if I ought to do it. But Plumfield is about as cheerful as a churchyard, you know, and I'd rather be excused. We had a flurry getting the old lady off, and had a fright every time she spoke to me, for I was in such a hurry to be through that I was uncommonly helpful and sweet, and feared she'd find it impossible to part from me. I quaked till she was fairly in the carriage, and had a final fright, for as it drove off, she popped out her head saying, Josephine, won't you? I didn't hear any more, for I basely turned and fled. I did actually run, and whisked round the corner where I felt safe. Poor old Jo. She came in looking as if bears were after her, said Beth, as she cuddled her sister's feet with a motherly air. Aunt March is a regular samphire, is she not? Observed Amy, tasting her mixture critically. She means vampire, not seaweed. But it doesn't matter. It's too warm to be particular about one's parts of speech, murmured Jo. What shall you do all your vacation? Asked Amy, changing the subject with tact. I shall lie abed late and do nothing, replied Meg, from the depths of the rocking chair. I've been routed up early all winter and have to spend my days working for other people. So now I'm going to rest and revel to my heart's content. No, said Jo, that dozy way won't suit me. I've laid in a heap of books, and I'm going to improve my shining hours reading on my porch in the apple tree, when I'm not having... Don't say larks, implored Amy, as a return snub for the samphire correction. I'll say nightingales then, with Laurie. That's proper and appropriate, since he's a warbler. Don't let us do any lessons, Beth, for a while, but play all the time and rest, as the girls mean to, proposed Amy. Well, I will, if Mother doesn't mind. I want to learn some new songs, and my children need fitting up for the summer. They're dreadfully out of order and really suffering for clothes. May we, Mother? Asked Meg, turning to Mrs. March, who sat sewing in what they called Marmy's Corner. You may try your experiment for a week and see how you like it. I think by Saturday night you will find that all play and no work is as bad as all work and no play. Oh dear, no. It will be delicious, I'm sure, said Meg complacently. I now propose a toast, as my friend and partner Sari Gamp says. Fun forever and no grubbing, cried Jo, rising, glass in hand, as the lemonade went round. They all drank it merrily and began the experiment by lounging for the rest of the day. Next morning, Meg did not appear till 10 o'clock. Her solitary breakfast did not taste good, and the room seemed lonely and untidy, for Jo had not filled the vases, Beth had not dusted, and Amy's books lay scattered about. Nothing was neat and pleasant but Marmy's Corner, which looked as usual. But there Meg sat to rest and read, which meant to yawn and imagine what pretty summer dresses she would get with her salary. Jo spent the morning on the river with Laurie, and the afternoon reading and crying over the wide, wide world up in the apple tree. Beth began by rummaging everything out of the big closet where her family resided, but getting tired before half done, she left her establishment, topsy-turvy, and went to her music, rejoicing that she had no dishes to wash. Amy arranged her bower, put on her best white frock, smoothed her curls, and sat down to draw under the honeysuckle, hoping someone would see and inquire who the young artist was. As no one appeared but an inquisitive Daddy Longlegs, who examined her work with interest, she went to walk, got caught in a shower, and came home dripping. At tea time, they compared notes, and all agreed that it had been a delightful though unusually long day. Meg, who went shopping in the afternoon and got a sweet blue muslin, had discovered, after she had cut the breadths off, that it wouldn't wash, which mishap made her slightly cross. Jo had burned the skin off her nose boating and got a raging headache by reading too long. Beth was worried by the confusion of her closet and the difficulty of learning 3 or 4 songs at once, and Amy deeply regretted the damage done her frock, for Katie Brown's party was to be the next day, and now, like Flora McFlimsy, she had nothing to wear. But these were mere trifles, and they assured their mother that the experiment was working finely. She smiled, said nothing, and with Hannah's help did their neglected work, keeping home pleasant and the domestic machinery running smoothly. It was astonishing what a peculiar and uncomfortable state of things was produced by the resting and reveling process. The days kept getting longer and longer. The weather was unusually variable, and so were tempers. An unsettled feeling possessed everyone, and Satan found plenty of mischief for the idle hands to do. As the height of luxury, Meg put out some of her sewing, and then found time hang so heavily that she fell to snipping and spoiling her clothes in her attempts to furbish them up a la Moffat. Jo read till her eyes gave out, and she was sick of books, got so fidgety that even good-natured Laurie had a quarrel with her, and so reduced in spirits that she desperately wished she had gone with Aunt Marsh. Beth got on pretty well, for she was constantly forgetting that it was to be all play and no work, and fell back into her old ways now and then. But something in the air affected her, and more than once her tranquility was much disturbed. So much so that on one occasion she actually shook poor, dear Joanna and told her she was a fright. Amy feared worst of all, for her resources were small, and when her sisters left her to amuse and care for herself, she soon found that accomplished and important little self a great burden. She didn't like dolls, fairy tales were childish, and one couldn't draw all the time. Tea parties didn't amount to much, neither did picnics, unless very well conducted. If one could have a fine house full of nice girls or go travelling, the summer would be delightful, but to stay at home with three selfish sisters and a grown-up boy was enough to try the patience of a Boas, complained Miss Malaprop, after several days devoted to pleasure, fretting, and ennui. No one would own that they were tired of the experiment, but by Friday night, each acknowledged, to herself, that she was glad the week was nearly done. Hoping to impress the lesson more deeply, Mrs. March, who had a good deal of humour, resolved to finish off the trial in an appropriate manner, so she gave Hannah a holiday and let the girls enjoy the full effect of the play system. When they got up on Saturday morning, there was no fire in the kitchen, no breakfast in the dining room, and no mother anywhere to be seen. "Mercy on us, what has happened?" cried Jo, staring about her in dismay. Meg ran upstairs and soon came back again, looking relieved but rather bewildered and a little ashamed. "Mother isn't sick, only very tired, and she says she's going to stay quietly in her room all day and let us do the best we can. It is a very strange thing for her to do. She doesn't act a bit like herself. But she says it has been a hard week for her, so we mustn't grumble but take care of ourselves." "That's easy enough, and I like the idea. I'm aching for something to do. That is some new amusement, you know," added Jo quickly. In fact, it was an immense relief to them all to have a little work, and they took hold with a will, but soon realized the truth of Hannah's saying, "Housekeeping ain't no joke." There was plenty of food in the larder, and while Beth and Amy set the table, Meg and Jo got breakfast, wondering as they did why servants ever talked about hard work. "I shall take some up to Mother, though she said we are not to think of her, for she'd take care of herself," said Meg, who presided and felt quite matronly behind the teapot. So a tray was fitted out before anyone began and taken up with the cook's compliments. The boiled tea was very bitter, the omelette scorched, and the biscuits speckled with saleratus, but Mrs. March received her repast with thanks and laughed heartily over it after Jo was gone. "Poor little souls, they will have a hard time, I'm afraid, but they won't suffer, and it will do them good," she said, producing the more palatable viands with which she had provided herself, and disposing of the bad breakfasts, so that their feelings might not be hurt, a motherly little deception for which they were grateful. Many were the complaints below, and great the chagrin of the head cook at her failures. "Never mind, I'll get the dinner and be servant, you be mistress. Keep your hands nice, see company, and give orders," said Jo, who knew still less than Meg about culinary affairs. This obliging offer was gladly accepted, and Margaret retired to the parlour, which she hastily put in order by whisking the litter under the sofa and shutting the blinds to save the trouble of dusting. Jo, with perfect faith in her own powers and a friendly desire to make up the quarrel, immediately put a note in the office, inviting Laurie to dinner. "You'd better see what we've got before you think of having company," said Meg, when informed of the hospitable but rash act. "Oh, there's corned beef and plenty of potatoes, and I shall get some asparagus and a lobster for a relish," as Hannah says. We'll have lettuce and make a salad. I don't know how, but the book tells. I'll have blancmange and strawberries for dessert, and coffee too, if you want to be elegant. Don't try too many messes, Joe, for you can't make anything but gingerbread and molasses candy fit to eat. I wash my hands at the dinner party, and since you've asked Laurie on your own responsibility, you may just take care of him. I don't want to do anything but to be civil to him and help to the pudding. You'll give me your advice if I get in a muddle, won't you? Asked Joe, rather hurt. Yes, but I don't know much except about bread and a few trifles. You had better ask Mother's leave before you order anything, returned Meg prudently. Of course I shall. I'm not a fool. And Joe went off in a huff at the doubts expressed of her powers. Get what you like and don't disturb me. I'm going out to dinner and can't worry about things at home, said Mrs. March when Joe spoke to her. I never enjoyed housekeeping and I'm going to take a vacation today and read, write, go visiting and amuse myself. The unusual spectacle of her busy mother rocking comfortably and reading early in the morning made Joe feel as if some unnatural phenomenon had occurred, for an eclipse, an earthquake or a volcanic eruption would hardly have seemed stranger. Everything is out of sorts somehow, she said to herself, going downstairs. There's Beth crying. That's a sure sign that something is wrong in this family. If Amy is bothering, I'll shake her. Feeling very much out of sorts herself, Jo hurried into the parlor to find Beth, sobbing over Pip, the canary, who lay dead in the cage with his little claws pathetically extended, as if imploring the food for want of which he had died. It's all my fault. I forgot him. There isn't a seed or a drop left. Oh, Pip, how could I be so cruel to you? Cried Beth, taking the poor thing in her hands and trying to restore him. Joe peeped into his half-open eye, felt his little heart, and finding him stiff and cold, shook her head and offered her a domino box for a coffin. Put him in the oven, and maybe he'll get warm and revive, said Amy hopefully. He's been starved, and he shan't be baked now he's dead. I'll make him a shroud and he shall be buried in the garden, and I'll never have another bird, never, my Pip. For I am too bad to own one, murmured Beth, sitting on the floor with her pet folded in her hands. The funeral shall be this afternoon, and we will all go. Now don't cry, Bethy, it's a pity, but nothing goes right this week, and Pip has had the worst of the experiment. Make the shroud and lay him in my box, and after the dinner party we'll have a nice little funeral, said Jo, beginning to feel as if she had undertaken a good deal. Leaving the others to console Beth, she departed to the kitchen, which was in a most discouraging state of confusion. Putting on a big apron, she fell to work and got the dishes piled up, ready for washing, when she discovered that the fire was out. Here's a sweet prospect, muttered Jo, slamming the stove door open and poking vigorously among the cinders. Having rekindled the fire, she thought she would go to market while the water heated. The walk revived her spirits, and flattering herself that she had made good bargains, she trudged home again after buying a very young lobster, some very old asparagus, and two boxes of acid strawberries. By the time she got cleared up, the dinner arrived and the stove was red hot. Hannah had left a pan of bread to rise. Meg had worked it up early, set it on the hearth for a second rising, and forgotten it. Meg was entertaining Sally Gardner in the parlor when the door flew open and a flowery, crocky, flushed and disheveled figure appeared, demanding tartly, I say, isn't bread ris enough when it's run over the pans? Sally began to laugh, but Meg nodded and lifted her eyebrows as high as they could go, which caused the apparition to vanish and put the sour bread into the oven without further delay. Mrs. March went out, after peeping here and there to see how matters went, also saying a word of comfort to Beth, who sat making a winding sheet while the dare departed lay in state in the domino box. A strange sense of helplessness fell upon the girls as the grey bonnet vanished around the corner, and despair seized them when a few minutes later Miss Crocker appeared and said she'd come to dinner. Now this lady was a thin, sallow spinster with a sharp nose and inquisitive eyes who saw everything and gossiped about all she saw. They disliked her, but had been taught to be kind to her simply because she was old and poor and had few friends. So Meg gave her the easy chair and tried to entertain her while she asked questions, criticized everything, and told stories of the people whom she knew. Language cannot describe the anxieties, experiences, and exertions which Jo underwent that morning, and the dinner she served up became a standing joke. Fearing to ask any more advice, she did her best alone, and discovered that something more than energy and goodwill is necessary to make a cook. She boiled the asparagus for an hour and was grieved to find the heads cooked off and the stalks harder than ever. The bread turned black, for the salad dressing so aggravated her that she could not make it fit to eat. The lobster was a scarlet mystery to her, but she hammered and poked till it was unshelled and its meager portions concealed in a grove of lettuce leaves. The potatoes had to be hurried, not to keep the asparagus waiting, and were not done at the last. The blancmange was lumpy, and the strawberries not as ripe as they looked, having been skillfully deaconed. Well, they can eat beef and bread and butter if they are hungry. Only it's mortifying to have spent your whole morning for nothing, thought Jo, as she rang the bell half an hour later than usual, and stood, hot, tired, and dispirited, surveying the feast spread before Laurie, accustomed to all sorts of elegance, and Miss Crocker, whose tattling tongue would report them far and wide. Poor Jo would gladly have gone under the table as one thing after another was tasted and left, while Amy giggled, Meg looked distressed, Miss Crocker pursed her lips, and Laurie talked and laughed with all his might to give a cheerful tone to the festive scene. Jo's one strong point was the fruit, for she had sugared it well, and had a pitcher of rich cream to eat with it. Her hot cheeks cooled a trifle, and she drew a long breath as the pretty glass plates went round, and everyone looked graciously at the little rosy islands floating in a sea of cream. Miss Crocker tasted first, made a wry face, and drank some water hastily. Jo, who refused, thinking there might not be enough, for they dwindled sadly after the picking over, glanced at Laurie, but he was eating away manfully, though there was a slight pucker about his mouth, and he kept his eye fixed on his plate. Amy, who was fond of delicate fare, took a heaping spoonful, choked, hid her face in her napkin, and left the table precipitately. "Oh, what is it?" exclaimed Jo, trembling. "Salt, instead of sugar. And the cream is sour," replied Meg with a tragic gesture. Jo uttered a groan and fell back in her chair, remembering that she had given a last hasty powdering to the berries out of one of the two boxes on the kitchen table and had neglected to put the milk in the refrigerator. She turned scarlet and was on the verge of crying when she met Laurie's eyes, which would look merry in spite of his heroic efforts. The comical side of the affair suddenly struck her, and she laughed till the tears ran down her cheeks. So did everyone else, even Croaker, as the girls called the old lady, and the unfortunate dinner ended gaily with bread and butter, olives and fun. "I haven't strength of mind enough to clear up now, so we will sober ourselves with a funeral," said Jo, as they rose, and Miss Crocker made ready to go, being eager to tell the new story at another friend's dinner table. They did sober themselves, for Beth's sake. Laurie dug a grave under the ferns in the grove. Little Pip was laid in, with many tears by his tender-hearted mistress, and covered with moss, while a wreath of violets and chickweed was hung on the stone which bore his epitaph, composed by Jo while she struggled with the dinner. "Here lies Pip March, who died the 7th of June, loved and lamented sore, and not forgotten soon." At the conclusion of the ceremonies, Beth retired to her room, overcome with emotion and lobster. But there was no place of repose, for the beds were not made, and she found her grief much assuaged by beating up the pillows and putting things in order. Meg helped Jo clear away the remains of the feast, which took half the afternoon, and left them so tired that they agreed to be contented with tea and toast for supper. Laurie took Amy to drive, which was a deed of charity, for the sour cream seemed to have had a bad effect upon her temper. Mrs. Marsh came home to find the three older girls hard at work in the middle of the afternoon, and a glance at the closet gave her an idea of the success of one part of the experiment. Before the housewives could rest, several people called, and there was a scramble to get ready to see them. Then tea must be got, errands done, and one or two necessary bits of sewing neglected until the last minute. As twilight fell, dewy and still, one by one, they gathered on the porch where the June roses were budding beautifully, and each groaned or sighed as she sat down, as if troubled or tired. "What a dreadful day this has been," began Jo, usually the first to speak. "It has seemed shorter than usual, but so uncomfortable," said Meg. "Not a bit like home," added Amy. "It can't seem so without Marmee and little Pip," sighed Beth, glancing with full eyes at the empty cage above her head. "Here's mother, dear, and you shall have another bird tomorrow if you want it." As she spoke, Mrs. March came and took her place among them, looking as if her holiday had not been much pleasanter than theirs. "Are you satisfied with your experiment, girls, or do you want another week of it?" she asked, as Beth nestled up to her, and the rest turned toward her with brightening faces, as flowers turn toward the sun. "I don't," cried Jo decidedly.
"Nor I," echoed the others.
"You think, then, that it is better to have a few duties and live a little for others, do you?" "Lounging and larking doesn't pay," observed Jo, shaking her head. "I'm tired of it. I mean to go to work at something right off."
"Suppose you learn plain cooking."
"That's a useful accomplishment," said Mrs. March, laughing inaudibly at the recollection of Jo's dinner party, for she had met Miss Crocker and heard her account of it.
"Mother, did you go away and let everything be, just to see how we'd get on?" cried Meg, who had had suspicions all day.
"Yes. I wanted you to see how the comfort of all depends on each doing her share faithfully. While Hannah and I did your work, you got on pretty well, though I don't think you were very happy or amiable. So I thought, as a little lesson, I would show you what happens when everyone thinks only of herself. Don't you feel that it is pleasanter to help one another, to have daily duties which make leisure sweet when it comes, and to bear and forbear that home may be comfortable and lovely to us all?"
"We do, Mother, we do," cried the girls.
"Then let me advise you to take up your little burdens again, for though they seem heavy sometimes, they are good for us, and lighten as we learn to carry them. Work is wholesome, there's plenty for everyone. It keeps us from ennui and mischief, is good for health and spirits, and gives us a sense of power and independence better than money or fashion. We'll work like bees and love it too. See if we don't," said Jo. "I'll learn plain cooking for my holiday task, and the next dinner party I will have shall be a success. I'll make the set of shirts for Father instead of letting you do it, Marmee. I can and I will, though I'm not fond of sewing. That will be better than fussing over my own things, which are plenty nice enough as they are," said Meg. "I'll do my lessons every day and not spend so much time with my music and dolls. I'm a stupid thing and ought to be studying, not playing," was Beth's resolution, while Amy followed their example by heroically declaring, "I shall learn to make buttonholes and attend to my parts of speech."
"Very good. Then I'm quite satisfied with the experiment and fancy that we shall not have to repeat it. Have regular hours for work and play, make each day both useful and pleasant, and prove that you understand the worth of time by employing it well. Then youth will be delightful, old age will bring few regrets, and life will become a beautiful success in spite of poverty."
"We'll remember, Mother." And they did.
Chapter 12. Camp Lawrence. Beth was postmistress, for being most at home, she could attend to it regularly, and dearly liked the daily task of unlocking the little door and distributing the mail. One July day she came in with her hands full and went about the house leaving letters and parcels like the penny post.
"Here's your posy, Mother. Laurie never forgets that," she said, putting the fresh nosegay in the vase that stood in Marmee's corner and was kept supplied by the affectionate boy.
"Miss Meg March, one letter and a glove," continued Beth, delivering the articles to her sister, who sat near her mother stitching wristbands.
"Why, I left a pair over there, and here's only one," said Meg, looking at the grey cotton glove.
"Didn't you drop the other in the garden?"
"No, I'm sure I didn't, for there was only one in the office. I hate to have odd gloves."
"Never mind. The other may be found. My letter's only a translation of the German song I wanted. I think Mr. Brooke did it, for this isn't Laurie's writing."
Mrs. March glanced at Meg, who was looking very pretty in her gingham morning gown, with the little curls blowing about her forehead, and very womanly as she sat sewing at her little work table, full of tidy white rolls,
so unconscious of the thought in her mother's mind as she sewed and sang, while her fingers flew and her thoughts were busied with girlish fancies as innocent and fresh as the pansies in her belt. And Mrs. March smiled and was satisfied. Two letters for Dr. Joe, a book and a funny old hat, which covered the whole post office and stuck outside, said Beth, laughing as she went into the study where Joe sat writing. What a sly fellow Laurie is. I said I wished bigger hats were the fashion because I burn my face every hot day. He said, why mind the fashion? Wear a big hat and be comfortable. I said, I would if I had one. And he has sent me this to try me. I'll wear it for fun and show him I don't care for the fashion. And hanging the antique broad brim on a bust of Plato, Joe read her letters. One from her mother made her cheeks glow and her eyes fill, for it said to her, my dear, I write a little word to tell you with how much satisfaction I watch your efforts to control your temper. You say nothing about your trials, failures, or successes, and think perhaps that no one sees them but the friend whose help you ask daily. If I may trust the well-worn cover of your guidebook, I too have seen them all, and heartily believe in the sincerity of your resolution, since it begins to bear fruit. Go on, dear, patiently and bravely, and always believe that no one sympathizes more tenderly with you than your loving mother. That does me good. That's worth millions of money and pecks of praise. Oh, Marmy, I do try. I will keep on trying and not get tired since I have you to help me. Laying her head on her arms, Jo wet her little romance with a few happy tears, for she had thought that no one saw and appreciated her efforts to be good. And this assurance was doubly precious, doubly encouraging, because unexpected, and from the person whose commendation she most valued. Feeling stronger than ever to meet and subdue her Apollyon, she pinned the note inside her frock as a shield and a reminder lest she be taken unaware, and proceeded to open her other letter, quite ready for either good or bad news. In a big, dashing hand, Laurie wrote, Dear Joe, some English girls and boys are coming to see me tomorrow, and I want to have a jolly time. If it's fine, I'm going to pitch my tent in Longmeadow and row up the whole crew to lunch and croquet, have a fire, make messes, and all sorts of larks. They are nice people and like such things. Brooke will go to keep us boys steady, and Kate Vaughan will play propriety for the girls. I want you all to come. Can't let Beth off at any price, and nobody shall worry her. Don't bother about rations. I'll see to that and everything else. Only do come. There's a good fellow. In a tearing hurry, yours ever, Laurie. Here's richness, cried Jo, flying in to tell the news to Meg. Of course we can go, Mother. It will be such a help to Laurie, for I can row and Meg see to the lunch, and the children be useful in some way. I hope the Vaughans are not fine, grown-up people. Do you know anything about them, Jo? Asked Meg. Only that there are four of them. Kate is older than you, Fred and Frank, twins about my age, and a little girl, Grace, who is 9 or 10. Laurie knew them abroad and liked the boys. I fancied, from the way he primmed up his mouth in speaking of her, that he didn't admire Kate much. I'm so glad my French print is clean. It's just the thing and so becoming, observed Meg complacently. Have you anything decent, Joe? Scarlet and grey boating suit. Good enough for me. I shall row and tramp about, so I don't want any starch to think of. You come, Bethy. If you won't let any boys talk to me. Not a boy. I like to please Laurie, and I'm not afraid of Mr. Brooke. He is so kind. But I don't want to play or sing or say anything. I'll work hard and not trouble anyone. And you'll take care of me, Joe. So I'll go. That's my good girl. You do try to fight off your shyness, and I love you for it. Fighting faults isn't easy, as I know, and a cherry word kind of gives the lift. Thank you, Mother. And Joe gave the thin cheek a grateful kiss, more precious to Mrs. March than if it had given back the rosy roundness of her youth. I had a box of chocolate drops and the picture I wanted to copy, said Amy, showing her mail. And I got a note from Mr. Lawrence asking me to come over and play to him tonight before the lamps are lighted, and I shall go, added Beth, whose friendship with the old gentleman prospered finely. Now let's fly round and do double duty today so that we can play tomorrow with free minds, said Jo, preparing to replace her pen with a broom. When the sun peeped into the girls' room early next morning to promise them a fine day, he saw a comical sight. Each had made such preparation for the fete as seemed necessary and proper. Meg had an extra row of little curl papers across her forehead. Joe had copiously anointed her afflicted face with cold cream. Beth had taken Joanna to bed with her to atone for the approaching separation. And Amy had capped the climax by putting a clothespin on her nose to uplift the offending feature. It was one of the kind artists used to hold the paper on their drawing boards, therefore quite appropriate and effective for the purpose it was now being put. This funny spectacle appeared to amuse the son, for he burst out with such radiance that Joe woke up and roused her sisters by a hearty laugh at Amy's ornament. Sunshine and laughter were good omens for a pleasure party, and soon a lively bustle began in both houses. Beth, who was ready first, kept reporting what went on next door, and enlivened her sister's toilet by frequent telegrams from the window. "There goes the man with the tent. I see Mrs. Barker doing up the lunch in a hamper and a great basket. Now Mr. Lawrence is looking up at the sky and the weathercock. I wish he would go too. There's Laurie, looking like a sailor, nice boy. Oh, mercy me, here's a carriage full of people. A tall lady, a little girl, and two dreadful boys. One is lame, poor thing, he's got a crutch. Laurie didn't tell us that. Be quick, girls, it's getting late. Why, there is Ned Moffat, I do declare. Meg, isn't that the man who bowed to you one day when we were shopping? So it is. How strange that he should come. I thought he was at the mountains. There is Sally. I'm glad she got back in time. Am I all right, Joe? Cried Meg in a flutter. A regular daisy. Hold up your dress and put your hat on straight. It looks sentimental tipped that way, and will fly off at the first puff. Now then, come on. Oh, Joe, you're not going to wear that awful hat. It's too absurd. You shall not make a guy of yourself, remonstrated Meg, as Joe tied down with a red ribbon the broad-brimmed, old-fashioned leghorn Laurie had sent for a joke. I just will, though, for it's capital. So shady, light, and big. It will make fun, and I don't mind being a guy if I'm comfortable. With that, Joe marched straight away, and the rest followed. A bright little band of sisters, all looking their best in summer suits, with happy faces under the jaunty hat brims. Laurie ran to meet and present them to his friends in the most cordial manner. The lawn was the reception room, and for several minutes a lively scene was enacted there. Meg was grateful to see that Miss Kate, though 20, was dressed with a simplicity which American girls would do well to imitate, and she was much flattered by Mr. Ned's assurances that he came especially to see her. Joe understood why Laurie crimmed up his mouth when speaking of Kate, for that young lady had a standoff, don't-touch-me air, which contrasted strongly with the free and easy demeanor of the other girls. Beth took an observation of the new boys and decided that the lame one was not dreadful, but gentle and feeble, and she would be kind to him on that account. Amy found Gracie, well-mannered, merry little person, and after staring dumbly at one another for a few minutes, they suddenly became very good friends. Tents, lunch, and croquet utensils having been sent on beforehand, the party was soon embarked, and the two boats pushed off together, leaving Mr. Lawrence waving his hat on the shore. Laurie and Joe rowed one boat, Mr. Brooke and Ned the other, while Fred Vaughan, the riotous twin, did his best to upset both by paddling about in a wherry like a disturbed water bug. Joe's funny hat deserved a vote of thanks, for it was of general utility. It broke the ice in the beginning by producing a laugh. It created quite a refreshing breeze, flapping to and fro as she rode, and would make an excellent umbrella for the whole party if a shower came up, she said. Kate looked rather amazed at Joe's proceedings, especially as she exclaimed, "Christopher Columbus," when she lost her oar. And Laurie said, "My dear fellow, did I hurt you?" when he tripped over her feet in taking his place. But after putting up her glass to examine the strange girl several times, Miss Kate decided she was odd, but rather clever, and smiled upon her from afar. Meg, in the other boat, was delightfully situated, face to face with the rowers, who both admired the prospect and feathered their oars with uncommon skill and dexterity. Mr. Brooke was a grave, silent young man with handsome brown eyes and a pleasant voice. Meg liked his quiet manners and considered him a walking encyclopedia of useful knowledge. He never talked to her much, but he looked at her a good deal, and she felt sure that he did not regard her with aversion. Ned, being in college, of course, put on all the airs which freshmen think it their bounden duty to assume. He was not very wise, but very good-natured, and altogether an excellent person to carry on a picnic. Sally Gardner was absorbed in keeping her white peak dress clean and chattering with the ubiquitous Fred, who kept Beth in constant terror by his pranks. It was not far to Longmeadow, but the tent was pitched and the wickets down by the time they arrived. A pleasant green field with three wide-spreading oaks in the middle and a smooth strip of turf for croquet. "Welcome to Camp Lawrence," said the young host, as they landed with exclamations of delight. "Brooke is Commander-in-Chief, I am Commissary General, the other fellows are staff officers, and you ladies are company. The tent is for your special benefit, and that oak is your drawing room. This is the mess room, and the third is the camp kitchen. Now let's have a game before it gets hot, and then we'll see about dinner." "Good night,"